From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, MoviePass promised a movie ticket a day for just 10 bucks a month. Was it too good to be true? And producer Bruna Papandrea adapts books for TV and film, including Big Little Lies and Gone Girl. She talks about how she picks material.
I mean, I think it's very kind of instinctual, actually. Like, sometimes you just literally see it as you're reading it. You know, it's kind of so easy to see it dramatized. The bigger question for me became, is it TV or film?
And Taj Mahal and Keb Mo have inspired each other for decades. Now they've made an album together. All that coming right up. Ever since last summer, when MoviePass dropped its subscription fee to $10 a month, the deal seemed, well, crazy. Questions swirled around our office. How is it possible to see a movie every day for just $9.95 a month? And could it last? But many movie fans, even Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Fritz, who covers the film business, put those worries aside and, in the interest of a very good bargain, signed up. Now, though, the deal isn't looking quite so good. When I reached Ben on Skype earlier today, he explained why.
What MoviePass promised was that you could pay a subscription fee per month, $9.95, a la Netflix, and have essentially unlimited movies. It was, you could see one new movie per day in more than 90% of theaters in America. And that's a crazy deal. I mean, it's a great deal anywhere in the U.S. if you see more than one movie per month.
But you say crazy, and I guess that's really part of the problem. If people are using it maybe to see 10 movies a month, I don't see what the economic model is. So maybe that gets us to the next series of questions. If you're paying 10 bucks a month and you're seeing, say, 10 movies, which could be more than $150 in L.A., how does that work economically for MoviePass and, more importantly, for the theater owners?
Well, for the theater owners, it works great because MoviePass, in most cases, pays the full price of the ticket. So the theater owner isn't losing anything. For MoviePass, it's, of course, a problem. The more movies we see, the more money they lose. So it's in their interest that we see as few films as possible. Their claim has always been, well, they're going to get a lot of subscribers, are going to get a lot of subscriber data, and that will be valuable. They can use it to sell advertisements. They can leverage that big user base to pressure theaters into giving them discounts on tickets or a cut of concession sales. And they'll become a company that has tons of data on frequent moviegoers, and that'll make them valuable and eventually perhaps an acquisition target. That was their goal. But the question always was, can they hold on until they get to that place and not lose too much money in the meantime? And that's the conundrum they're in right now.
One of the things that seems like MoviePass was trying to tap into is this Netflix model of subscription, that you pay your monthly fee and then you can do what you want to do, see a lot of stuff, see not so much stuff. Here's a clip of Greg Lemley. He's the co-owner of the small Lemley theater chain here in Southern California. Here's what he has to say about MoviePass.
I think what MoviePass has shown us is that price is important to the consumer. And as theaters start charging more and more for tickets, there is an impact on attendance. Now, we can simply address it by lowering our transactional price or creating opportunities for discounted transactional. You know, the subscription model is difficult because as theater owners, we don't control the product. Our license fee is based on a split of box office revenue with the studios. So they want their piece of the pie for every person that walks in the door, and well, they should.
So is he hinting at part of the problem that MoviePass finds itself in now? What has happened in the last week or so that has really hurt the company's fortunes?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the difference between Netflix and MoviePass is that it doesn't cost Netflix any more money when I watch an extra show. They completely own the rights to all the TV shows and movies that they have. So the more I consume, it doesn't matter to them. But every time I see a movie with MoviePass, they have to pay more money to the theater, and with the theater then splits it with the studio. So it costs them money the more I consume, even though I'm not paying anymore. So that's the difference. That's their financial problem. So far, they're essentially in the business of selling dollars for dimes. And the more people that sign up, the more money they've been losing, especially during the busy summer movie season. So they now have more than 3 million subscribers, and they're burning through a lot of cash. I think their burn rate has been up to about $45 million per month. And they're desperately short on cash. They really can't pay their vendors. They've been borrowing money at very high interest rates. And a couple of times, their vendors appear to have shut down access, and the app has stopped working briefly. People haven't been able to see certain movies. So now, as a result, MoviePass is changing the terms. They both raised the price, and they've limited the number of movies people can see. in a pretty desperate effort to stay afloat.
So they have gone from about $10 a month to $15 a month, but the whole idea of MoviePass is unlimited access, and now it sounds as if big blockbuster films are not available for, what, first couple of weeks of release?
That's right. The first couple of weeks they come out, you can't see them at all. So like right now, you can't see the new Mission Impossible movie, for example. So basically, the most popular films that open nationwide, you won't be able to see them for the first 2 weeks. And even after that, if the movie's popular, there's sometimes going to be a surcharge on top of your $15 per month.
And it also sounds like some theater chains are starting their own subscription model. AMC has a version. How does that compete with MoviePass?
So with AMC's version, it costs a little bit more. It's $20 per month, and you can see fewer films per month with it, but there are certain advantages to it. You can see any IMAX film. You can see 3D films with it. Most importantly, you can see any movie you want. So you could go see Mission Impossible right now, and there's no extra surcharges for anything. You can see Mission Impossible 5 days in a row, in fact, if you want, whereas with MoviePass, you can only see the same film once. And I think most importantly, because AMC is a big company, it's a financially stable company, you don't have to worry that it's going to disappear in a few weeks or suddenly stop working one day because they can't pay their bills.
Mission Impossible seems like a fitting film to talk about MoviePass's options right now. Its parent company's stock has been plummeting. It might be delisted on the NASDAQ. Is there a conceivable way out for MoviePass right now?
It is very hard to imagine, John. I mean, they're so short on cash. Investors are punishing them. Their total market cap, which means the amount that Wall Street thinks the company is worth, is currently less than $1 million. A lot of people in Los Angeles could sell their house and theoretically buy up all the stock and own MoviePass. It's that grim. So it's hard to imagine them coming back from this. Perhaps they could find someone who's willing to buy them. They do have 3 million plus subscribers. They have a brand name that people know. I think that's sort of the only conceivable outcome, and or I should say they go into bankruptcy.
Ben Fritz covers the film business for the Wall Street Journal. Ben, always great to have you on the show.
It's always great to talk to you, John.
Coming up, why producer Bruno Papandrea is eagerly buying up books about women, often written by women, to adapt for the screen. Did you ever read a book and think, this could make a great movie? Well, that's what Bruno Papandrea does on a regular basis. When the Australian producer ran a production company with Reese Witherspoon, she turned the memoir Wild and the novel Gone Girl into movies and the book Big Little Lies into a hit HBO series. Last year, Papandrea launched her own production company. It's called Made Up Stories, and she continues to tell tales about women, often based on books written by women. The first book she bought for her new company is called All These Beautiful Strangers. It's the debut novel by Elizabeth Clayfoth, and it's just been published. Set at an East Coast boarding school, the lead is a teenage girl who's trying to uncover a family mystery while navigating a dark, hidden world at her school. Bruna and Elizabeth recently joined me in studio.
Do you want me to tell you a little bit about how it came to me?
Sure.
Because it's a great story.
I know it's unusual because it was before it was published.
That's right.
But
that's happened many times. But what's great about this story is it's a little bit the kind of Hollywood dream story, which is I have a very good friend, someone actually who's worked with me in various capacities over the years, called Brendan Kenny. And he kept saying to me for a long time, oh, my friend Elizabeth's writing a book and you should read it. And I was like, oh, yeah, someone else's friend is writing a book. I've never heard that before. And so I kind of ignored it. And he sent it to me. To be honest, I was pretty busy. I was just starting the business and I kind of ignored it again. And then he called me and said, you know, there's a lot of activity around the book. And in fact, WME is reading it this weekend. And my ears kind of suddenly pricked up. I was like, oh, your friend Elizabeth, of course. Oh, my God, I'm halfway through that book. You know, did the typical producer thing.
Why?
Totally lied. But I literally picked it up. And then, of course, like all great things that I've optioned, I couldn't put it down. And, you know, I'd obviously just started the company and books had been a big part of my life in terms of book to film. But the one thing that it had kind of always eluded me was kind of my favorite genre, which was that world of the secret history.
You're referencing the Donna Tartt book, right?
Yeah, the Donna Tartt book, which, you know, is much beloved, I think, by so many women of different ages and men. But the other thing that I'd always said is like, where's My Cruel Intentions? Where's that? Because I'm fascinated by young people and kind of by the complexity of those relationships. And the genre of a thriller, I literally could not put it down. And I knew kind of immediately that I wanted to do it.
And Elizabeth, at this point, you had a manuscript, but not a publisher. You're looking for a publisher. What was the status of the book's publication?
Yeah, so I just landed my agent at WME, and we hadn't even taken it out to publishers at that point when I got the call from Bruna.
And did she say, I want to do this? And you said, but so do other people. I mean, did you take some other calls? And was there something about Bruna's pitch that made you want to work with her?
I was a huge fan of, you know, Big Little Lies, Wild, Gone Girl, a lot of the adaptations that she had worked on, and her vision to, you know, bring to the screen and to TV these really complex female-driven stories. And so, you know, if I were to make a wish list of who I would want to do this, Bruna would be like at the top. So I didn't feel the need to meet with anybody else because I felt like she was really perfect.
Bruna, one of the challenges for a producer when he or she is reading a book or any other kind of material is, I enjoy this. I'm enjoying the story. I'm lost in the story versus, is there a movie in this? How do you read something and navigate those two things, which are often contradictory? You can like something and know that there's no movie in it, or you can say something's really not that good, but there is a movie to be made. How is it for you reading something like this, and how do you balance those two ideas?
I mean, I think it's very kind of instinctual, actually. Like, sometimes you just literally see it as you're reading it. You know, it's kind of so easy to see it dramatized. I think when things are a kind of more internal voice, and you the challenge then becomes like, how do you dramatize them? But I didn't find that with this, and also because this had such a kind of powerful thriller engine, then I kind of saw it immediately. The bigger question for me became, is it TV or film? Which is the big question we ask with everything we read these days.
What are the factors? What weighs for one, what weighs for the other?
With something like Big Lies, for instance, it was obvious to me from the outset that it was so important to really understand and explore character over time, you know, because part of the nuance of that show, obviously, and particularly exploring things like domestic violence, is being able to kind of really look at every side of it and every angle and do that over time. I think with this, again, because of the super compelling thriller narrative at the center, what Emma Frost, who is the screenwriter, and I talked a lot about, is it 100% could have been a High and Limited, but as a movie, it is kind of a heart-pounding thriller. And that was very exciting to me because I really felt like, you know, movies like, you know, Gone Girl and, you know, Cruel Intentions, there's a real deficit of those in the market. And I really felt like that, you know, young people particularly are like dying to go to the movies to see these.
We're talking with producer Bruna Papandrea and novelist Elizabeth Clayfoth about her book, All These Beautiful Strangers. I want to ask you both about this idea that you keep saying, this young people idea, because there have been reviewers who have talked about the book as a young adult book. I'm not sure I totally agree with that categorization. But in your mind, Bruna, what do you see as the audience for this film? Because it is set in a high school, and yet it's also about some grown-up issues and about parents and about what has happened to this woman's parents.
Yeah, I see it as for both, actually. And again, that's one of the things that attracted me initially, was that I saw it as, you know, speaking to both young people and kind of an older demographic, you know, because I don't think it fit into, you know, one category. And I think that she's going to see that with, in terms of who's responding to the book and, you know, how the book gets received. Because I know that I could give this to, you know, a lot of different people and they would love it.
Elizabeth, what about you? I mean, did you see it as a certain genre?
So when I was writing it, in my head, it was a young adult novel, and I pitched it to agents as a young adult novel. And my agent at WME was the first person who said to me, you know, this could be an adult novel too. It kind of teeters on the edges of both genres. So don't box yourself into having this be one thing. And it's interesting because in the U.S. it's technically published as adult, but in the U.K. It was just published as young adult. And I've been kind of reading the reviews as it comes in, and it does seem to really translate to both audiences. I've had adults read it who say this is, you know, an adult domestic suspense thriller novel, and I've had young adults read it and say that they really connected, you know, with the characters. So I think it kind of teeters on the edges of both and kind of goes both ways. So you have the best of both worlds, kind of.
Elizabeth, there are a couple of different options that novelists tend to have when their work is being adapted for a film. One is take it, do with it what you will. I'll see you when the film comes out. The other is I want to be involved in the process. Even if that's going to be a difficult process, I'm going to fight for things, you're going to fight for things, we'll figure out what the happy medium is. Where do you see yourself? What do you want to do? What's your inclination? And how do you see it playing out?
I feel like I'm kind of in the middle of those two things. I felt very lucky that I got to sit down with Emma Frost, who's writing the screenplay, before she started penning the screenplay. And she asked me, you know, what were my important takeaways from the book? You know, what would I not want to see change? What was I okay with? So I felt very lucky to be involved in that part of the process. But I'm also pretty hands off in that I feel like the book is one thing, and the book to movie adaptation, it has to be, you know, something different, and changes have to come into play. And I'm very okay with that. I feel like, you know, I couldn't have asked for a better creative team to be at the helm of this. And I trust, you know, their creative decisions.
The book is now just coming out. Is it important or helpful that the reviews and the sales are good? And how does that benefit the development of the film?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a great question. It's so interesting to me. I mean, I've definitely had studios who, when a book didn't become the success they wanted, the film version definitely slowed up or, you know, didn't happen. I think a lot of people are kind of banking on the success of a book. You know, what's really important to us in Made Up Stories is that the book, you know, thrives in its own way, and we try and support that in any way we can. But I've had experiences like that on Wild where the book was a huge success. Gone Girl was a huge success, and obviously the movies were too. But I've also had experiences with, you know, the movie I made, Warm Bodies, and even Big Little Lies, to a certain extent, it was not Leanne's most successful book, you know, by a long shot. I mean, Husband's Secret is by far her most successful book. But then creating the kind of, you know, the content around that just brought people back to the book. And so I've seen it happen always. And with Warm Bodies, that was definitely the case. You know, the movie obviously really brought people back to the book. So it doesn't matter to me. Obviously, I want it to, you know, I want people to love it like I do. And I want and think it deserves to be, you know, well reviewed. But you can see that from the timing. We'll have a script within, you know, a month. So
if things go quickly, I mean, we're talking in July of 2018.
Yeah.
We could have a movie a year from now.
That's right. Yeah.
What is that like, Elizabeth? I mean, that's kind of amazing. You're just now going out on the book tour, and that there's a possibility if the stars align, so to speak, that come a year from now, you'll be doing it all over again in a different capacity.
Yeah.
No, as executive producer, be sure to get executive producer credit.
Thanks, John.
Okay. We'll talk about deal points too in a minute. Elizabeth and Bruna, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for having us.
Elizabeth Clayfoth is the author of All These Beautiful Strangers. Bruna Papandrea is a producer who's adapting her book into a movie. Up next on The Frame, a long overdue collaboration between two blues veterans. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. This show airs every weekday at 3:30 and again at 7 p.m., but you can always listen at your leisure by subscribing to our daily podcast, and that way you won't miss a single episode. Last week, for example, we had interviews with musicians Boz Scaggs and Charlotte Gainsbourg, and in the coming weeks, you'll hear my chats with many Emmy Award nominees, including actor Jeff Daniels from Godless and The Looming Tower, and Portlandia's Carrie Brownstein. You can get The Frame's podcast through all the leading podcast sources, including Apple and Stitcher. And now, L.A. native Kevin Moore, known by his stage name Keb Mo, was just a teenager when he first heard Taj Mahal play. As Keb Mo's career developed, he would often cross paths with his idol, and almost 50 years after their first encounter, Keb Mo and Taj Mahal finally made their first collaborative album. It's called Taj Mo.
Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett spoke with Taj Mahal and Kevmo last year when their album came out, and they began by recalling the first time that they'd heard each other play.
First time I heard about Taj Mahal, I heard Taj Mahal. And that was in 1969 at Compton High School, where Taj Mahal did a performance with his band at my school.
Bet you're going fishing all of the time, baby going fishing too.
That was the first time I heard about him. Then about a year, 2 years later, my friend Robert Mims, he bought a four-track of Natural Blues, and he said, I bought this thing at the store downtown somewhere, and I listened to it. I don't like it that much. So he gave it to me, and it was Taj Mahal Natural Blues. So I was like, oh, I'll take that. Put it in, and I wore that thing out.
Thank you. I mean, I heard about him, you know, from lots of different sources, and he played in between sets at some of my shows or before shows, but we still hadn't played together yet.
First time we played together was in, I remember it was at the old House of Blues in Cambridge.
True, that's right.
First time we got there. Yeah. I remember on the stage because I knew I wasn't quite in it. You gave me the look.
Now you know you're up here.
Without Corina, sure don't mean a natural thing.
I don't think we ever really trying to make something together. We were always just bumping into each other at gigs and things. There was never enough room to really even forge a relationship of any, right, like, you know, significance. But then in Atlanta, at a Greg Allman tribute, we kind of talked about it there, and then we decided to make a record at that time. And then we followed through, and we made one. The collaboration with Bonnie Raitt, it's more like an appearance on the record, came when we were working in Berkeley at Fantasy Studios, and she dropped by to check out what we were doing, because she lives over in the Bay Area. And the other guests, Joe Walsh, was in the neighborhood. He came by the house. And we were working, and he came by, and he brought his guitar and amp and commenced to playing.
Yeah, sure did. We live on different sides of the country. And unfortunately, through modern technology, we can get together and do different things. And, you know, Kev has a studio in his house in Nashville, so could come there, you know, stay, hang, record, spend time getting it done without some other outside producer who had some idea of put some clothes on us that we didn't want to wear.
That's funny.
You know?
That's funny.
I can't tell you how much excitement, because we had a chance to learn one another's style, and most of all, just to be really honest while you're doing this process, you know. In the blues, there's a style that I've got that tends to be kind of like what we call shouting in key. You're not singing, but you're shouting in the key of the song that you're playing in.
Different world whiskey.
This is funny. My speaking voice will be like this. With some music up there, totally changed.
Honey, and I never come home.
The biggest thing to do is to start singing softly before you start.
My back door someday.
Get it warmed up, and then when you get to the gig, I jump, go right to sleep.
Right, and turn off the air conditioning.
Yeah, turn off the air conditioning.
That'll ruin you.
The wind's gonna rise and blow my blues away.
I don't know about you, Todd, but I'm kind of an in-the-moment guy. I don't really think that far out into the future and plan stuff.
Me neither.
I think that's getting in trouble. It's like, you know, yeah. How do you make God laugh? Make plans.
Yeah, right. Exactly. There was no choice of songs to say, okay, well, here's what's happening politically. Let's write a song or find a song that matches that circumstance. The tradition behind, the deep African tradition behind what it is that we're doing were the griots who brought the news, who knew the great deeds of their predecessors. So we're not out of pocket at all.
Society goes in cycles, and the same things happen over and over again. Mm-hmm. There's always corruption. There's always people that are good and kind and do amazing things. It's always happening all the time. So in the music, telling the truth about life, well, your truth is part of the bigger truth. So you don't have to worry about how you're informing the audience or whatever like that. We're one united being. We're all one thing. We're not really separate. If you think we're separate, that's when it makes it difficult.
Taj Mahal and Keb Mo perform on August 1st at the Hollywood Bowl. Also on the bill are Melissa Etheridge and Taj's daughter, Diva Mahal. And that's our show for today. Remember, you can keep up with us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.